Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Colonel Douglas McGregor, who is a decorated combat veteran, the author of four books, the latest of which is Warrior's Rage. McGregor was commissioned in the U.S. Army in 1976 after 1 year at the Virginia Military Institute and 4 years at West Point, and served in the Gulf War, leading the U.S. Army's largest tank battle since World War II. McGregor has testified as an expert witness on national security issues before the House Armed Services Committee and the House Foreign Relations Committee. He is a supporter of Ron Paul and a spokesperson for veterans groups that are organizing marches and demonstrations on behalf of Republican candidate for president Ron Paul. Welcome to Background Briefing, Colonel Douglas McGregor.
Thank you.
And it would seem a bit of a paradox that a military man would be supporting Ron Paul, who, if you watched the Republican primaries, debates, of which there were a lot, he was sort of treated as an eccentric, but he was the only person that was actually talking seriously about the extent to which the American empire is threatening the Republic, or how much, whether the Republic will survive the empire, and calling for, a real look into the wars that we've been engaged in and why we get into them, and why we should get out of them, in effect. And so that's my first puzzlement. I know it's a long question, but why a military man being with somebody who's considered a peacenik?
Well, I don't know. I haven't heard the peacenik attached to Ron Paul, but then again, maybe nobody decided to say that to my face.
Well, I could probably find a more pejorative word that somebody like a Newt Gingrich threw at him, but the general feeling was that he would be a disaster for American national security. That was the attitude that the Republican candidates had.
Well, the Republican Party, frankly speaking, bears very resemblance to the Republican Party of 35, 40, 50 years ago. It has become very much like the Democratic Party in many of its attitudes. And most important, there isn't a great deal of daylight between some of the people you mentioned who've been running for president and their views on foreign and defense policy and, let's say, Lyndon Johnson or Richard Nixon. And I think that's part of the reason that I and so many others with experience in the military, specifically people who've been in action, regarded the statements about the United States, its position in the world, and its real interests seemed disconnected from reality. That's the best way I can think of to describe the statements by, Newt Gingrich on foreign and defense policy, or Santorum, or Romney. They don't seem to be aware that the long and difficult period of debt-financed consumption as the basis for economic growth is about over, that we are on the verge of a very serious fiscal crisis that's going to hurl us into something I think is going to look like the Great Depression. And I think that Ron Paul's grasp of economic reality, frankly, is one of the reasons that many of us listen to him, but also because we served in these places, Afghanistan, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, the Emirates. We've been in these places. We've seen the people that are there. We understand what is attainable and what isn't. And quite frankly, the goals that were set by the neocons under the Bush administration were entirely unrealistic. And we've squandered trillions of dollars and thousands of lives and blood and treasure on what was always a fool's errand. And so to listen to people who want us to go forward and engage in yet more fool's errands is something we weren't willing to do.
Well, it's pretty extraordinary to think that the candidate who got the Republican nomination has been running for president for 10 years and has not bothered to develop a military doctrine or a foreign policy doctrine, and is outsourcing it all to the neoconservatives, the same people who brought us the Iraq War. That I find extraordinary, that he literally would have a kind of vice president in charge of the military and vice president in charge of foreign policy as though he were corporate CEO. I mean, I find that disturbing, not just the neocons, but the fact that he doesn't seem to have developed any thoughts or policies regarding the military and foreign policy.
Well, first of all, I think you're right, although I would apply much of the same description when it comes to foreign and defense policy to President Obama. I think that Obama probably had stronger feelings about what he didn't want to do, but he inevitably capitulated to effectively the same kinds of people surrounding him that surrounded George Bush, with the same connections to the neocons, to Wall Street, and so forth. So I don't think that's all that surprising. Unfortunately, I don't think there's much interest in the American electorate at this point in what I would call real substance. I know that sounds harsh, but things aren't bad enough to induce people to demand accountability and fundamentally change a fundamental change in direction. I think that's the largest issue. I think that everything that Ron Paul has been saying and advocating will be vindicated in the years ahead, particularly on the foreign and defense policy side, where I think we'll simply run out of money and we'll withdraw from most of the places that are being depicted as vital to us, which in fact are not. So I agree with you. I just don't know that there's a great deal that we can do about it, because I don't think people are very interested. I mean, I talk to lots of Americans, and most Americans want desperately to be patriotic. They want to believe in certain things about their country. And when you tell them that bombing people in remote places is not really a demonstration of American greatness, they have become so accustomed to what I would call remote war without consequences to them personally, they are immediately afflicted with cognitive dissonance. They can't grasp it. They listen to it in the mainstream media day and night, that someone in a remote mountainous region of Yemen has to be killed or the survival of the republic is at stake. It's all nonsense. It's absolutely wrong. But they've been conditioned to accept that. And since they don't connect the dots at this point, they don't understand the trillions that have been lost. And I say trillions, it's not just $1.3 or $1.4 trillion. They don't perceive any damage to us overseas. They don't understand the consequences for the armed forces or the selection system that produces senior officers that are willing fellow travelers for these bad ideas and bad policies. So unfortunately, before we're going to see anything change in the United States in that regard, I think we're going to have to see a much tougher set of conditions domestically, economically.
Again, I'm speaking with Colonel Douglas McGregor, who is a decorated combat veteran, the author of four books, the latest of which is Warrior's Rage, and he led the U.S. Army's largest tank battle since World War II in the Gulf War, and has testified as an expert witness on national security issues before the House Armed Services Committee and the House Foreign Relations Committee. And in terms of you being a supporter of Ron Paul, polling has indicated that both among veterans and serving military, Ron Paul is the favorite candidate by a considerable margin. Again, how do you explain that? If in many ways he's talking about that we really have to look at the broader utility of our armed forces and to some extent retreat back to the United States in again using the analogy that the republic is threatened by the empire, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Well, there has always been in every nation in the history of Western civilization a connection between a large, powerful, and intrusive federal government at home and a large military presence and activity overseas. That's not news, and Ron Paul is simply warning people that the two are connected, and we can't become healthy here at home until we also deal with the problem overseas. My own view is that the problem overseas, Ian, is going to take care of itself. I mean, the British left India not when the British should have left India, which was many decades earlier, when it was no longer a commercially viable operation to stay, where there was no profit involved, if you will, for the British. They left when they ran out of money and resources. And that happened after two devastating world wars that left Britain in ruins and destroyed its prosperity and national power. We're not as bad off as Britain was at the end of these two world wars, but we are running into very hard financial times. And as a result, I think most of what's happening overseas will be dramatically scaled back. Then the question is, what do you do with what's left over? That's something that we should talk about. But the second part, I think, is very, very important of what you mentioned earlier. And that is that the veterans themselves, they know how money is spent inside the military establishment. People think if you allocate a dollar to defense, you get a dollar's worth of defense out of the dollar. You don't. We have an expression in the Army, nothing's too good for the troops, and nothing is usually what they get. That's meant as black humor. And it is black humor in the sense that people don't understand that you don't get necessarily what you pay for, and trillions disappear into all sorts of people's pockets. They don't necessarily produce viable military power. I think that has a big impact. And again, you know, the recognition that we could occupy most of the world outside of Western civilization and have almost no impact whatsoever except to create and cultivate enormous hostility against us. And that's something that people, again, at home don't understand. You tell the average American, look, we're exporting democracy and everyone is grateful to us. How would he know the truth? No one bothers to tell him the truth. And again, the truth isn't very popular. You tell him, no, our interventions have been disasters, self-defeating. And lots of people look at you and think, well, you must not like America, which, of course, is absurd. Because those of us who serve in the military wouldn't serve at all if we didn't fundamentally believe in our country and in this republic. But we know that the whole thing is at risk unnecessarily because of these imprudent overseas adventures.
Well, in terms of the military-industrial complex, it's always been clear that the priority has been the toys and not the boys. And I don't know whether you saw the recent 60 Minutes piece, Colonel McGregor, where two serving pilots in the Air Force went public, risking their careers, to explain that they're blacking out from lack of oxygen in flying the Raptor, which is about $500 million a copy.
Yeah.
And they can't even fly the things to the point where they can be proficient because they're so quirky and expensive. Going back to the Iraq War, which the Israeli military historian Martin Van Creewell described as the worst strategic blunder since Emperor Augustus led his armies into Germany in 9 AD. The president seemed to do that in many ways for personal reasons. They never had, it turns out, Colin Powell's revealed this recently, they never had one cabinet meeting to discuss going into Iraq. And it seemed like Cheney did the entire end game around everybody, including the president. And, you know, I don't want to be too cynical, but let's face it, the only people that profited from the Iraq War were the Halliburtons of this world. The Iraqi people certainly suffered, and the U.S. military servicemen and their families suffered.
Well, there are also a lot of people, so-called contractors, retired 4 stars, 3 stars, some in the defense industry, because not all of the defense industry has profited. But those are the people that also profited handsomely, I might add, and so did many politicians because of interests in their districts and constituents that they have that were involved in contracting and profiting from the episode. There's something else, though. I can't resist the opportunity to say this. Van Creefeld was right, but he failed to tell everyone the rest of the story. And the rest of the story is that after the 3 Roman legions and auxiliaries were destroyed in Germany, Augustus did hold a meeting, had a council, and they made the decision to simply lie about it. And so for decades thereafter, there was really very little appreciation inside the Roman population for the scale of the disaster in Germany. Other than the prudent decision was then made not to cross the Rhine anymore, and very few incursions were made. But the truth is that the solution was to lie. And quite frankly, the Romans got away with it. They lied about this terrible defeat. And I'm afraid that we've got a similar situation now. People are just lying about what did or did not happen in Iraq. And it goes on with Afghanistan. And again, the public seems ready at this point to still accept the lie.
So, Colonel McGregor, what do you make about the New York Times on Memorial Day front page story? West Point asks if a war doctrine was worth it, a spirited debate on counterinsurgency and its costs. It's as a former U.S. military man, and obviously you're in touch with serving people as well. It seems to me that there is quite a lot of reflection, to put it mildly, going on within the military about what were these two wars about. I mean, here we are on Veterans Day, you know, thinking about war and the cost of war, and those that made the sacrifices. It's a pretty bitter pill, isn't it, that these wars were completely unnecessary, counterproductive, and we'll be paying for them forever.
Well, keep in mind that the 3 and 4 star generals, some of whom are retired and some of whom are still on active duty, are the people that profited from their contribution to the disaster. There isn't much reflection on their part. And if you, depending upon which news station you turn to, there are lots of them on to tell the American people what a huge success it was, and to talk about the bravery and the courage of the soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines who fought and gave their lives. So the reflection is at relatively low levels, and I think Colonel Gentile, who was mentioned in that up at West Point, is the tip of the proverbial iceberg when you get down to the full colonel level and below. But if you think there are large numbers of ones and two stars, all of whom want to be three and four stars, who are prepared to stand up and discuss any of this honestly and openly, you're very much mistaken. And I don't see any evidence that anyone in the Obama administration wants to touch it. Everyone would prefer just to forget about it and walk away. And that's the problem. We forgot about things at the end of the Vietnam War and walked away. I suspect we'll do the same thing with Iraq and Afghanistan. And that's ill-advised, because we certainly don't want to continue this. But again, there is a group in Washington, political, military, and commercial, that is very interested in these things and will do whatever they can to find ways to justify these types of interventions in the future. And this is what Ron Paul has been talking about. It's what he's running against. It's why he's not going to be nominated. But I do believe that in the long run, he will be vindicated over the next 2-3 years in particular.
But Colonel McGregor, do you think that the military will? I mean, some people have said that Petraeus being at the CIA is not so much about the CIA becoming militarized, but more about the Pentagon becoming more like the CIA, in as much as smaller footprint, which is what happened in Afghanistan initially, more special forces, drones, etc., and not these big standing armies. Is that
well? Remember that you maintain general purpose forces, Army, Navies, Air Forces, as a strategic hedge against the possibility that you may have to fight in a war that you would otherwise avoid. That is the historic American rationale for standing armed forces. That changed in 1991 when the Clinton regime came to power, and you will recall Madeleine Albright, who challenged Colin Powell and said, "You're always talking about this great army, so why can't we use it?" And the left began the process of employing military power in support of whatever cause they saw anywhere in the world that interested them, that could become a laboratory for experimentation to realize their utopian dreams. And we've been on that slope ever since, and the Bush administration did nothing to interrupt it. In fact, the Bush administration turned into an extension of it.
Well, that was the right wing,
though. We've been through 20 years of this. It's just that the last 10 have been particularly expensive and destructive. And I think we're at the end of the period. I do think Americans have had enough. But again, connecting the dots is not easy. There's a book out by this fellow Rasmussen who does polling. He doesn't really tell us anything new, but he points to something that anyone who studied American history understands, that there really hasn't been much movement in the thinking of the American people over the last 200 years about overseas interventions and foreign entanglements. The majority of the American population doesn't want it. It never has. And so to get the American population involved in these things, they've had to be effectively hoodwinked into things, dragged into things, persuaded that something was true that wasn't in most cases. And I think that's what's happened over the last 20 years. I think we're at the end of it because we can't afford it. The real question is, will we ultimately expel this bipartisan elite in Washington from power that pushes these bad policies? And I think there's an opportunity over the next 2 or 3 years because of this very serious fiscal crisis that's headed our way.
Well, just on the notion that the left going back to the Balkans were having utopian fantasies, I think that most of the pressure on the left was largely about humanitarian considerations. It seems that the real damage was done on the right by the neoconservatives, who truly were recklessly utopian.
Having been part of it, Ian, I disagree with you, because I was involved in the planning for the intervention in Haiti. Mm-hmm. And I was on the tail end of the Somali intervention. And then, of course, I was involved in the intervention in Bosnia-Herzegovina and subsequently in the Kosovo bombing campaign. And many of the same actors were present throughout these events and came back to life again and had a big role with Mr. Wolfowitz and his crew in arguing for the dismantling of the Iraqi army, its government, its administration, so the place could be neo-Nazified and turned into some sort of utopia that would eventually become friendly to Israel. So I think all of these people are birds of a feather. One may stand a little to the left of the center, the other to the right, but they're all very similar. And so having served with all of them and seen all of them in action, there isn't much difference. And the humanitarian card is routinely played as justification for all sorts of things. I heard that played on the way into Iraq and then subsequently in Afghanistan. All of these pleas from people like Blair and Clinton that were about humanitarian intervention to save the Muslim Albanians from the evil Serbs, those things were repeated again shortly after we went into Afghanistan. That justified a large footprint there with the object of transforming this pathetic area of the world, this tragic place, into some sort of utopian liberal democracy. You say, this is not new, but my point is this 20-year period is about over. And the real question is, what do we do next? And what do we do about the people that have been delivering these disasters to us over and over and over again?
Well, and meanwhile, of course, we don't intervene in the Congo, where 5 million people have been butchered. So it's kind of
selective. Well, if you
want
to go, I encourage you to try. But again, I don't think the United States Armed Forces were created to be world policemen for the purpose of transforming other societies, stopping people from killing each other. This sort of thing has been going on for a very long time without us. It's going to go on without us once we leave all of these places. In fact, the lesson of history, which the neocons in particular don't want to learn, is that if you'll get out of the Middle East and North Africa, the lesson of the last 1,000 years is these people aren't going to bother you, but they're going to spend a lot of time fighting with each other.
Well, on that note, Colonel McGregor, I'm afraid we're running out of time, but I thank you so much for joining us here on Veterans Day and for offering your perspective. It's
well, thank you for inviting me in.
Again, I've been speaking with Colonel Douglas McGregor, who is a decorated combat veteran, the author of 4 books, the latest of which is Warrior's Rage. He was commissioned into the United States Army in 1976 after 1 year at the Virginia Military Institute and 4 years at West Point, and served in the Gulf War, leading the U.S. Army's largest tank battle since World War II. McGregor testifies as an expert witness on national security issues before the House Armed Services Committee and the House Foreign Relations Committee. He is a supporter of Ron Paul and is a spokesperson for veterans groups that are organizing marches and demonstrations on behalf of Republican candidate for president Ron Paul. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with Jacob George.
This is a war we can win. After 10,000 years, it's still us against them, and my heroes have always died at the end. So who's going to account for these sins? And I don't